So with our keynoter's perspective fresh in mind, we will charge ahead into our final segment of the day. We gave this discussion the title Turkey Between Russia and the West. Over the course of several years, Turkey's role in the region has gone from the goal of zero problems with neighbors to armed intervention, and relations with Europe and with the United States have deviated from the predictability one might expect from NATO allies or in the European Union accession process. During the same period, Ankara's relations with Moscow suffered the Turkish shootdown of a Russian plane in 2015, but also saw Russia draw Turkey into its diplomacy with Iran surrounding the Syrian conflict. So we have an outstanding panel today to address these issues, and I have an announcement to make. A member of parliament from the CHP was going to be here with us today on the foreign policy panel. He checked into his hotel room yesterday, and we've heard he was in town, but we were informed that he would not be taking part in today's discussion. And to lead the discussion, we are very fortunate to have Amberin Zaman. She has written extensively on Turkish domestic and foreign policy, including issues of minority rights and Turkish relations with Armenia and with the Kurds. She has been a reporter for major US and UK newspapers and a columnist in the Turkish press, and currently contributes to Turkey Pulse in the online El Monitor. And earlier this year, she completed a productive stint as a public policy fellow at the Wilson Center. Over the next 90 minutes, she will be introducing the panelists and lead the conversation and take your questions to them. So please join me in thanking the panel and our moderator.
Okay, so this is probably one of the more exciting panels, I'd like to think, but that's probably unfair to people who spoke earlier today, so I've already kicked off with a rather undiplomatic comment, sorry. So we have a star-studded panel here, and the topic is, yes, Turkish foreign policy. And Turkey has gone from being a very stable, predictable, Western ally, critical member of the NATO alliance, to an increasingly unpredictable and unstable one. And so here today we have some fantastic panelists who will help us navigate through Turkey's astonishing sort of sea change over the past few years. And so to my right I have Koti Piri, who is a member of the European Parliament for the Dutch Labour Party. She's also the rapporteur for Turkey for the European Parliament, tracking very closely what's going on in Turkey and probably feeling utterly depressed about it. But to her credit, Koti is one of the most optimistic people I know. She's a great friend of Turkey, and she's also a very smart friend of Turkey, an extremely nice person, so delighted to have her. To my left, I have Jonathan Cohen, who's the Deputy Assistant Secretary at the State Department for Cyprus, Greece, and Turkey. He's had an extremely distinguished career. He's served in Turkey. He understands the Turkish-Kurdish dynamic very well because he was the person sitting in the embassy in Ankara who was sort of monitoring the whole situation in northern Iraq. And also, he was most recently the deputy chief of mission in Baghdad, Iraq. And we're hoping to get him to speak a lot today, which is something he doesn't do very often, certainly not with journalists. And then to the far right, I have Dimitar Beshev, who is an extremely distinguished scholar, an expert on Russia, on Turkey, who is currently at the University of North Carolina and who's just produced a magnificent book which I plan to buy and read, called Rival Power. He understands the Turkish-Russian dynamic extremely well, and he also heads a think tank in Bulgaria, Sofia, which is where he's originally from. And then to the far left, I have somebody who gets on my nerves quite a bit because he's one of the best Turkey analysts and, extremely young, as you can observe. So for an antique piece such as myself, it's rather discomforting, but he's great. So let's kick off with you, Mr. Cohen. So the Turkish-American relations, people are writing obituaries about them. In fact, we have somebody here in the audience, Ömer Taşpınar, who just wrote a very eloquent obituary of the relationship. Things look terrible. People are in this city certainly asking the question of whether Turkey remains a real ally. Is Turkey still a real ally of the United States? What are the strategic interests that continue to bind you to Turkey? What sort of leverage does the United States still have over Turkey, given that the current government seems to be set on a course of pushing anti-American feelings to the maximum possible extent with a view towards legitimizing its governance back at home, and clearly using the Zarrab case, the relationship with the YPG, as a means of stoking these anti-US feelings?
Well, that is quite a lead-in. Thank you, Enverin. I think to understand where we are today in U.S.-Turkey relations, we have to look back at where we've been and how we got here. For the last 65 years, the U.S. and Turkey have been NATO allies, and our relations have always been deep and complex. The partnership is a result of sustained diplomacy and very intensive engagement across a range of issues at all levels. And while Turkey has gone through some traumatic changes in the last couple years, those contacts have remained, and our consultations and our interest in issues in the region and beyond remain common in many aspects, and where they diverge, we have very intensive conversations about them. Turkey has the second largest military force in the alliance, and a dynamic economy, a population of 80 million people, a critical geographic position, and regional clout. That's an influence that we need to be mindful of and work with, and we do. Looking back over time, from the 1990s until 2003, Turkey facilitated the no-fly zone over northern Iraq, allowing it to develop in peace and to escape Saddam Hussein's tyranny. In Afghanistan, Turkey was a major troop contributor and remains one. And it also provides use of its airspace and allows and has allowed over time refueling of U.S. aircraft on missions both for Afghanistan and in Iraq and in the fight against ISIS, including over Syria. Apart from military relations, we share many goals and concerns. Like us, Turkey wants to limit Iranian and Russian influence in the region, notwithstanding cooperation on specific issues that Turkey is engaged in with those countries. It supports a unified sovereign Iraq, as we do. It supports a unified Syria and is trying to find a way to resolve the war there, as we are. And the Turkish government and people also deserve recognition for the enormous hospitality they've displayed in hosting more than 3 million Syrian refugees. In short, the U.S. continues to value Turkey's efforts to foster regional stability and its contributions to global security. Turkey is an important partner in the global coalition to defeat ISIS and provides critical bases for U.S. and coalition forces. From those bases, we conduct precision airstrikes, carry out intelligence, surveillance, and reconnaissance flights, maintain combat search and rescue units, and resupply coalition forces. And I could go on with the various benefits that accrue to the things we're trying to do in the region. Let me round this off by saying that it goes beyond the military. It includes deep and important economic ties and people-to-people contacts. Ankara seeks further improvement in each of these areas of cooperation, and so do we. And we're working to continue our efforts to develop constructive dialogue to maximize the enduring benefits of our strategic alliance with Turkey. Now, all that said, you want me to dive into the challenges of the relationship right now, and I think it's only fair to the audience that I do so. To frame this, I think we have to recognize that in the summer of 2016, Turkey underwent a traumatic event. The coup attempt shook the Turkish people and the Turkish state to the core. And I was in Turkey about 2 months after the coup attempt. And the Turks took me to the parliament building and showed me the holes that had been made in the roof of the parliament by their own Air Force's F-16s. And they asked me to imagine that something like that had happened here in the capital. What would my reaction be? How would our population feel? And it is a game changer. So with that as the context and with a, thank you, with a, it's with a deep sense of empathy for that event that I think we have to approach the Turks and try and figure out what's going on in Turkey and how we manage our relationship in that context. Right now, the major challenges in the bilateral relationship are led by two. The arrests of U.S. citizens and U.S. government employees, which resulted in the partial suspension of visa services between our countries, and the U.S. relationship with the YPG in Syria. I can get more into these things later, but I don't want to monopolize too much time. But the context in which we discuss this with the Turks, and it isn't always a satisfying answer for the Turks, but it is true. We're in a relationship with the YPG because we didn't feel we had an alternative in Syria. We needed to have a partner force that was immediately available to get ISIS out of Raqqa, and the YPG was the force that was available. Our relationship with the YPG is, as I've said before, temporary, transactional, and tactical. Our alliance with Turkey is strategic and enduring.
So now to you, Kati. Arguably, the European Union has more direct leverage over Turkey than any other sort of regional power bloc. And of course, as we all know, and as was discussed in detail this morning, relations with the European Union, too, are at rock bottom. Going forward, how do you balance the need to remain engaged with Turkey without seeming to reward this government that's been very steadily eroding the rule of law and doing the exact opposite of what it pledged to when it was granted full membership accession talks with the European Union back in 2005?
Well, to start with your assumption that we have more leverage, Turkey is, of course, a member of NATO. So once you're a member of an organization, that's where the leverage is. It's also a member of the OSCE, where also the US is a member. It's a member of the Council of Europe, and for a long time, it wanted to become a member of the European Union. Now, I'm not here to criticize either Turkey or the EU, but the EU certainly did not use that process in a very smart way. Mistakes have been made in the past by Turkey is the only country who we offered an open-ended membership, meaning even if you fulfill all the criteria, we will still have to see whether you can become a full member or not. We didn't do that with the Western Balkans. We allowed in 2004 when the talks kicked off, we also had a new member inside the EU, which was Cyprus, without the Cyprus issue being solved. And as the EU works, you need unanimity on many decisions. And of course, from the beginning, all the key chapters in the negotiations dealing with, you know, the core issues of membership is respect for the rule of law. These tools were blocked from the beginning. I'm not saying the EU is to blame for where Turkey is today. That would definitely go way too far. But we didn't always use all the opportunities we had in this process to actually encourage reforms. For instance, we didn't have any EU-Turkey deal, any EU-Turkey high-level meeting for many years, up until the moment that we wanted a transactional deal on the refugees. So, you know, with this, we didn't only lose, I think, the appetite in the political atmosphere in Turkey of the credibility of the EU, but I think we are slowly more and more also losing the Turkish public by not always being genuine in this process between the EU and Turkey. Having said that, as rapporteur of the European Parliament on Turkish EU accession, you wouldn't be surprised that I put more emphasis on human rights and rule of law rather than on strategic issues, which are, of course, also very much valid for the EU as such. But Turkey is the one who said it wants to become a member of the EU. It's not the EU who forced Turkey to come up and wanting to apply for membership. And with that, of course, we also hold higher standards to Turkey than what we do towards Russia or Egypt. Where we are now is, as you said, Ambreen, at the rock bottom of this relationship due to many issues. We have many EU citizens, most of them with dual nationality, in jail or not being able to leave Turkey. We had some elections also in Europe where we had very tough debates with the Turkish government, including in my own country. 4 days before the Dutch elections, we had quite a diplomatic row with the Turks, with the Turkish government when they wanted to come and campaign in the Netherlands. For many EU countries, Turkey is no longer only a foreign policy issue. It has become a domestic policy issue. In Germany, for sure, you just heard the story of Michel Müntefering in the Netherlands, in Austria, in France, but also in a country like Bulgaria with a minority from Turkey. Now, where do we go from here? It's too easy for me to say there is no strategy of the EU where to go from here. Probably there are different strategies. And this is one of the issues. If you have 28 countries and they don't agree on the strategy, the outcome is there isn't really one. Now, what I think in the European Parliament, what we think is that you have to look at a kind of dual approach. My biggest concern right now is that we are losing the Turkish public. It's one thing to lose a government from perhaps having their interest in closer EU accession. It's another thing to lose 80 million people. And this is where I think the EU has not always been very outspoken when it comes to human rights issues in Turkey, or at certain moments even been very silent, and where we don't do a lot, or at least not publicly, to engage with the Turkish civil society. You saw it on the visa issue, which is very important for people living in Turkey, that they can travel to the European Union. We saw now the debate when it comes to the modernization of the trade agreement we have, the so-called customs union between the EU and Turkey. Businesses in Europe are in favor, businesses in Turkey are in favor, trade unions in Europe are in favor, the same in Turkey. And still, we had the German election campaign where it kind of this stopped the process of even engaging in talks on upgrading that customs union. So I very much hope we can revive that again, because I think the leverage, if there is still any leverage left for the EU vis-a-vis the Turkish government, it is in the economy, where we know, although there were attempts to diversify the economy, it's still very much dependent on European businesses. I'm the last person to call for an economic boycott. I really want the best for the Turkish people, so no misunderstanding there. But I also think we need to engage in an honest dialogue at this, together with businesses, on calling, you know, attention for the state of emergency in Turkey and what kind of effect it has on society, for people in the private sector being dismissed or even jailed without due process. This is something which you cannot say that only politicians should do. I think the business community has a responsibility there too.
Well, what you just said ties into what I meant when I said European Union has most direct leverage, meaning the most significant trade relationship,
yes,
and investment. So turning to you, Dimitar, there's a lot of talk about Turkey shifting away from NATO, from the West, pivoting towards Russia, Iran, and this whole business of buying the S-400s, etc. How seriously do you take this? Do you think Turkey's really becoming part of Putin's orbit?
I think the headline shouldn't be pivoting. What appeals to me as a label is marriage of convenience. And it's a marriage of convenience that has lasted for a long, long time. Indeed, some building blocks were there even in the Cold War. Sorry to backtrack that much back in time, but any time there was a crisis, however serious, in relations between Turkey and the US, but also NATO, Moscow, be it the Soviet Union or Russia, was there. It was the case in the 60s and the 70s. And that's the case now. This marriage of convenience was already in the making in the 1990s. Putin and Erdogan, who came to personify it, give it a face, inherited certainly the economic cooperation between the two and gave it the spotlight. But ultimately, the 1990s were instrumental in building it. The gas trade kicked off under Turgut Özal. And then there was a moment when actually those two powers on the periphery of Europe saw each other as not just historical rivals, but also partners. Turkey accepted it wouldn't meddle in issues that were very critical to the Russians, the conflict in Chechnya being one, but also other volatile places in the former Soviet Union. And certainly Russia itself gave a very strong signal in the 90s to Turkey that it was not going to use the Kurdish issue as a way to destabilize Turkey. Some of you might remember when Abdullah Öcalan appeared in Moscow seeking asylum, and then part of the legislature pushed for that, and then the then Russian leadership said no. That was a strong signal. So there's a lot of things that are going on, and they're bound to be going on. Turkey, and that's another highlight, is seeking its strategic autonomy. Ömer Tashpanar, I'm indebted to him. He had a very apt label, speaking of Turkish Gaullism, right? Turkey is in NATO, but not of NATO sort of thing, trying to assert its independent role. And Russia is always there as an alternative, something to use as a hedge, to use as a leverage vis-a-vis Western partners, and occasionally use as protection if Turkish security is seen threatened by the West. And this seems to be the mentality of this government. Russia, on the other hand, is not in the business of regime change. It kind of favors Erdogan. And Russia has shown its potential to inflict damage. That's another issue that became very obvious with the brief trading war between the two after the shutdown of the jet. The targeted Russian sanctions inflicted enough damage in sectors that were not critical to Russia, certainly not in energy, but made life difficult for Erdogan. And one thing that changed, that's my last comment, compared to what was the state of play before the crisis. Well, before the crisis in Syria, before the shutdown, there was a compartmentalization. They agreed to disagree on Syria and proceeded with bilateral business on other issues. It shifted after the coup. Now Turkey believes that Russia is instrumental as the new power broker in Syria to secure Turkish interests in a future power-sharing agreement. So the idea is let's think about the common denominator in Syria and try to work from there. Of course, there are lots of caveats. First of all, Russia obviously cannot deliver on expectations. We saw it with the collapse of the Geneva round of talks. The amount of leverage it has over the Assad regime and over the Iranians is severely limited. But also the YPG issue, which is very critical to the US. Turkey relationship is bound to be a spoiler in ties with Russia. Just today we saw Russian generals, the Reconciliation Center, posing for a picture with the YPG command. The expectation that Moscow is downgrading its ties to the Syrian Kurds in order to strengthen connections to Turkey are misplaced. It's bound to keep options open, won't pivot back to Turkey if if you will. So the marriage of convenience will go, but it will be dysfunctional. And anytime those two hug together, we'll have to be asking ourselves what are the areas of disagreement. Last thing, the S-400s, let's see how it plays out. There's a lot of talk, but the substance might not be quite there, and expectations on the Turkish side might be, again, misplaced, what the Russians are prepared to provide.
So, Nicholas, who's standing in for the honorable member of the Turkish main opposition, CHP party. So I
deputy from Ardahan, if there's any doubt about that.
I could give you the unenviable task of being him and talking about Turkish foreign policy, but instead I'd like to ask you more about what it is that seems to inform Turkish foreign policy at the moment. Ever since I've been covering Turkey, since the early 90s as a journalist, to me it's often seemed that this paranoia about Kurdish separatism has really been the sort of telescopic lens through which Turkey saw, conceived, designed its foreign policy, and certainly which sowed the seeds of this rampant anti-Americanism that we now see when it thought that the US was setting up an independent Kurdish state in Iraq, and now we've seen that quite the opposite. The United States is quite fiercely battling that. To what extent do you think that this fear about Kurdish independence, separatism, and Western support for it is really at the root of what is poisoning the US-Turkish relationship at the moment? And if it's not just that, what else is?
So, yeah, I guess let me try to answer that in the most broad way possible. And then get back to the Kurdish issue more specifically at the end. What strikes me, we heard a very great explanation of all the different shared interests that the United States and Turkey still have. And then you brought up a striking example of a very much non-shared interest, a point where we're at striking disagreement. And yet I think what's, in terms of contextualizing both of these, what's worth keeping in mind is there's another much more profound shared interest that the United States and Turkey have. And it's one that's almost so obvious that we don't necessarily talk about. But the United States and the Turkish government both obviously share an interest in maintaining Turkey's stability. And yet the tragic irony of this, I think, is it's this shared interest that's driving us apart. And the Kurdish issue is a big part of this. People in Turkey, the Turkish government, is very much convinced that the United States is working to destabilize Turkey, specifically destabilize the Erdogan regime. In contrast to Moscow, which, you know, Erdogan certainly doesn't think Putin has his best interests in mind. Putin certainly doesn't have Erdogan's best interests in mind. But Erdogan doesn't worry that Putin is trying to overthrow him. Whereas because of a number of factors, the YPG being chief, U.S. support for the YPG being chief among them, also the Gulen case, the trial of Reza Zarab, a number of factors, I think, have led the Turkish government to genuinely believe that the United States is working to, you know, to undermine Turkey, to weaken Turkey, and specifically to weaken the Erdogan government. At the same time, the United States, people here, much more plausibly, I think, believe that it's Erdogan himself who's weakening Turkey, that it's Erdogan's divisive and authoritarian policies that are weakening the country. And getting back to your question, Erdogan's fixation now on taking a specifically militant approach to dealing with Turkey's domestic Kurdish issue. And so I guess, right, to the extent that Turkey's not just foreign policy, but to a large extent domestic policy, has now become dominated by its concerns over the Kurdish issue, to the extent that there was already powerful anti-Americanism in Turkey, this does get us to a pretty profound impasse. One of the most striking examples I'd give, you know, even when the United States helped the Turkish government capture Abdullah Öcalan, the leader of the PKK, there were people in Turkey who spun that into a conspiracy theory about how the United States actually did this in order to found a Kurdish state because Öcalan wasn't doing a good enough job promoting Kurdish interests, so we needed a better puppet. At the point where there was that level of paranoia going back one or two decades, to the point where the United States actually is working with an extension of the PKK, you know, this is going to be something very difficult for U.S. policy to overcome. And I think what makes this, you know, makes this impasse particularly frustrating, and I'm sure we'll talk more about this, is as people in Washington have gotten more frustrated with a lot of very genuinely provocative Turkish behavior, there's been a hope that the United States can deal with this in part by putting increased pressure on Erdogan. I think there are ways in which this could work, but I also think what the United States is up against is that, A, this pressure, unlike, say, when Moscow does it, is going to be interpreted through the lens of Erdogan's paranoia. It's going to seem at, you know, further attempts by the United States to destabilize Turkey. And the measures that are now being discussed, you know, increased fines against Halkbank, people on the Hill have talked about very narrow kinds of sanctions against members of Erdogan's government. You know, from the Turkish point of view, I think these would all pale in comparison to something like U.S. support for the YPG, which from the Turkish perspective would seem like a much more dramatic and dangerous form of pressure than anything we're talking about.
So, picking up on that, as you said back in May, the relationship with the YPG is temporary, transactional, and tactical. And so from that, are we to divine that it's, and given that the Raqqa operation has now ended and that the campaign against the Islamic State seems to be winding down, that in parallel to that, this relationship or affair, as the Turkish side might see it, with the YPG, is that ending? And if so, do you believe that this will help improve the relationship by removing that very enormous source of tension? My other question to you is, when will the United States be appointing an ambassador to Turkey to sort of oversee this turbulence that is rocking the relationship?
I thought you were going to ask me questions that I could answer. I don't have an answer for the second question. I really don't have insight into the timing, but there's an active process underway to try and take care of that. As regards to the YPG and the U.S. partnership there, it's going to be driven by developments on the ground. And as the Secretary of Defense said last week, we're going to go exactly along the lines of what the President announced. So,
could you clarify what the President said? Help us understand.
I can. Let me. I have to be a little careful here, but the partner that we have on the ground in Syria for our soldiers is the SDF. Which the SDF is comprised of the YPG, which is the Kurdish component, and Arab components. So they are our principal supporters as long as we have boots on the ground in Syria. The relationship with the YPG will transform over time as we get out of a battlefield situation and into a stabilization situation. And that's the transition that we're seeing now. I can't predict exactly how it's going to play out, but it will change over time.
Well, it's been suggested that the United States can use its leverage with the YPG to somehow help restart the peace process in Turkey. Do you believe that that kind of leverage actually exists, or that there's a will for that on either side, be it the Kurdish one or Ankara?
I'm not seeing anything, and I can't speak to the Kurdish side because I'm not engaging with them directly. But from Ankara's side, I'm not seeing an interest right now in re-engaging in peace talks.
Okay.
And I mean, the theory of the case, and if people want to talk afterwards, I'm happy to share my thoughts on when and how that might happen. But I don't think we're at a place either in terms of. Where the Turkish forces and the PKK are in their conflict, nor in terms of where the Turkish government is in terms of its politics to be able to get to the point that would allow talks to restart.
So, Kati, picking up on this lack of an appetite for resuming the Kurdish peace process, but more generally this sort of seeming descent into authoritarianism. There's talk of 2019 really being the real inflection point, that things will come to a crunch and the Turkey we know will really disappear for the foreseeable future, and we may not even have any more free and fair elections. And that Turkey becomes a great source of instability right on Europe's borders. Does Europe have a contingency plan? How does it deal with that kind of a Turkey? And what are the various scenarios that you foresee going forward unfolding in Turkey?
Well, if there is a contingency plan, they certainly didn't share it or made it public. I'm afraid that too many people in Europe either don't see how important the coming months are in the run-up to 2019. I think that's one of the biggest problems. Or perhaps cynically, something we anyway don't have leverage, so there's not a lot we can influence. I mean, both, I think, are bad. I think 2019, or if there will be earlier elections, in any case, the next presidential election, when the new constitution will kick into become effective, meaning that there's one man in control fully, also in legal terms, of the judiciary, and we can't speak of a division of power anymore, which is kind of the basis for any talk, I would say, also about EU membership. So I think we could see a drastic change in relationship between the EU and Turkey after 2019 if things continue the way they are heading now. What can be done is like I said, I mean, this is one of the difficulties. You know, you mentioned regime change, and I was like, regime change, you know, we never hear that in Europe, but then I thought you were referring to the US, but but honestly, I mean, the Erdogan was also the man. We always forget that Turkey was not a democracy 10-15 years ago. You know, also the best terms of the Kurdish question, which you just mentioned, Ambarin, I mean, there was one man willing to stick out his neck and start up the peace talks with the Kurds. And I think there's still, probably he's still the only political leader in Turkey who sees the necessity in the future. He might not see it, you know, at the right moment to do it now. If there's anyone outside of HDP who thinks probably, you know, that a Kurdish question has to be solved, it is probably Erdogan in the long run. So it is not, we, especially we in politics, want to see things very black and white. But unfortunately, when the longer you deal with Turkey, you see how many gray zones they are. And we don't always understand the sensitivities. You know, I always try to be first self-critical. And we didn't understand the sensitivity, like was mentioned to you, on the night of the coup and what happened and the impact it had. We really misread it. After day two, we were talking about the arrests, while the whole population was still in a trauma about what happened.
And you were mentioning to me in our conversation yesterday that the Gulenists seem to be hijacking the narrative on the whole Turkey discourse in Europe. Could you talk about that a bit, please?
Yeah, why not touch on all the sensitive issues in a public panel? But as I'm Dutch and I'm always very direct, I'll answer the question. The narrative is Erdogan is the bad guy, which means anyone who is against him must be the good guy. I mean, it's as simple as that. And without really truly understanding all the factors in Turkey and the history of Turkey, I'm afraid both in Washington on the Hill and in the European Parliament, the Gulen movement is still the best lobby there is, the strongest lobby there is, which is not always fair to the reality in Turkey. And it is causing, you know, also a lot of tension, of course, with the Turkish government. On the other hand, you know, while the Turkish government is rounding up everyone who belongs to the Gulen movement without any judicial process, their criticism on this no longer has a recipient. because we just are really very far away from reaching that point. And I think that's a pity, because there would have been strong support from all the allies for rounding up the people who are responsible for an attempted coup. This speaks for itself, but not the way it is being done now in Turkey. I mean, no one can defend the way that 160,000 people have been fired from their jobs, more than 50,000 people arrested without any due process. On top of that, our citizens are among them, mostly with dual nationality. So the same on PKK. I mean, it is something where, as the PKK fight, of course, mainly took place inside Turkey, we don't know much about the sensitivities in our countries. And this is something where I think, you know, with a more reasonable approach from the Turkish government, you could have a genuine dialogue about this, where also we are sometimes very blinded by our worldview. I remember in the Netherlands, you know, the moment that people are shook out of their black and white picture on Erdogan must be the bad guy, then all the others are good, or when they see the election results in Turkey. They're like, oh, so not everyone is supporting the AK Party, or when they saw the outcome of the referendum. Oh, really? Is the country so divided? There are also other voices. Because the only voice we hear is, of course, always, and it hasn't been a very nice voice in the last months, with comparisons of Nazis, with very, very tough rhetoric, where I think Turkey underestimates the impact this had also on our societies, of having such blatant, violent talks towards EU leaders. It just didn't set the environment to discuss these issues, where we should also sometimes look at ourselves. We're not at this stage. Did it answer your question? Not really.
Okay. No, that was great. So, Dimitar, parallels are very frequently drawn between Mr. Erdogan and Mr. Putin. Do you think that there really are similarities there, and if so, how would you characterize them? And in light of any that do exist, what can we predict for Mr. Erdogan's future?
Well, similarities do exist, but I think they're superficial. 2-3 years ago, I wrote a piece to that end, even before the whole saga around the coup happened and the turning of the screws in Turkey. Obviously, the authoritarian style, the big man, the father of the nation, also using the external threat as a way to legitimize and rule and to mobilize your constituents. But sometimes these are generic. These are generic features. You can find it in any such regime, be it a hybrid regime or be it a full-blown authoritarian system. Ultimately, Turkey and Russia are different. Turkey has a decent history of competitive politics, a flawed democratic system, and elections still to this day make a difference in the way they don't in Russia. You have a presidential election coming up in Russia, and it's important to make it look credible, but nobody, either the regime or its opponents, question the outcome. Well, the outcome in Turkey matters, even though it's not a level playing field. And one other difference that strikes me is that Turkey likes to play the game as if it's a post-imperial power, the Ottoman nostalgia and what have you, but it's a quintessential nation state with it all downsides and advantages. Russia is still a nation state in the making. Just think about the Russian boundaries. I mean, there are so many open conflicts. I mean, where does Russia end? And all those exclaves and enclaves. So the issue of boundaries is open. Russian is still the post-imperial language across the Soviet space. I mean, Azeri elites would talk in Russian. That's not the case in Egypt or Syria or elsewhere. Turkish is not the language of communication. So if you start digging deeper, you see all those differences. I mean, of course, those two leaders, they think they speak the same language and they understand viscerally one another. But I don't think the kind of trajectory Russia is caught in applies to Turkey. All things being equal, Turkey is embedded into the West institutionally, thanks to NATO, also the customs union. economically, and not least human links. Think about what we heard about the German situation, but also elsewhere. Those family ties, the hybrid identities in Western Europe. Of course, that's happening in Russia itself since the end of the Soviet regime and the collapse of the Soviet Union. Russia is much more embedded into the West, but in a very different ways. So I won't put my money on convergence, and I won't put my money on Russia and Turkey becoming part of the same universe.
And these so-called Eurasianists in the military, people like Dolpinchek, do you think their influence is being exaggerated?
Well, it's been around for a long time. Irony is that those people were amongst the hardest anti-Erdogan critics back in the day, who would rather see him hanged in Ankara as Menderes, because he was a stooge of the West. Remember those days? I mean, it looks like eons away, and now they've become fellow travelers, not least because they had a real grudge against Gulen and his people. But I'm not sure those ideologues play such a role. They are useful tools. The same way Eurasianists in Moscow, they're not core members of the regime. They're people who can be instrumentalized on occasion. And then the regime might take a very different tack, given the circumstances. We are talking about really rational, power-hungry people, of course, with their biases, their delusions, and their paranoias, both in the Kremlin and in the presidential palace in Ankara. But again, I think the ideological veneer doesn't explain that much. But having said that, I think there's business to be done between Russia and Turkey, and that coupling will continue, and it will continue under a very different regime in Ankara one day, and under Putin's successors as well.
Thank you for that extremely hopeful presentation you just gave us. It's very encouraging. And so thus, Nicholas, to you to sort of continue on that very hopeful note, and as a historian, looking forward, let's say for the next decade.
That's not how it works.
Tell us what Turkish foreign policy is likely to look like.
Instead of answering for the next decade, I'll answer for maybe the next 2 years. Is that okay?
Deal.
And even that I'm a little uncomfortable with, but since you asked. There's been a lot of talk, even some jokes made, about Turkey's transition from Ahmet Davutoğlu's original zero problems with neighbors to what Ibrahim Kalın once referred to recently as precious loneliness in the wake of the Arab Spring. And so if I had to predict what direction Turkish foreign policy is going in now and come up with an equally silly catchphrase for it, I would suggest angry pragmatism. And I think there have been a lot of examples where, especially looking towards the Middle East, Turkey's foreign policy is perhaps more pragmatic than its often very hostile nationalist rhetoric makes it seem. And yet I think the rhetoric is very real, and I think that's going to have real consequences, which are going to prevent Turkey from benefiting from some of the pragmatic impulses. I was really struck after the KRG referendum, before the actual conflict in Kirkuk had broken out, Ahmet Davutoğlu wrote a Facebook post about what he thought should happen. And it was really classic Davutoğlu. He talked about Kirkuk's history as a multicultural city. He talked about the importance of negotiating a solution where both sides avoided military action. Turkey could play a role as a moderator in this situation. I mean, it read kind of like an international crisis group report. And no one, as best I can tell, paid any attention to this Facebook post except MHP nationalist leader Devlet Bahçeli, who attacked Davutoğlu for a range of things, amongst others saying that Kirkuk was a multicultural city when everyone should know it was a Turkish city. At a point where Bahçeli had also said that he had, I think, 5,000 of his followers who were ready to march on Kirkuk. And then subsequently, then Davutoğlu had to write another Facebook post defending himself from Bahçeli's criticism. And it seemed to kind of summarize the rhetorical poles of the debate in Turkey, the kind of old Davutoğlu pragmatism, and then the fact that the public discussion and certainly Erdogan's rhetoric had moved much closer to this kind of Bahçeli angry nationalism. And yet, in spite of this, when you look at the policy that Turkey actually carried out towards the KRG, it was much more... It was somewhere in between the two. And there was, you know, that Turkey was clearly very critical of Barzani, was clearly happy to see him humiliated. But as far as actual actions that they took against Barzani, I mean, they imposed limits on flights going into the KRG. They held joint exercises with the Iraqi military, but oil kept flowing from Kurdistan through pipelines in Turkey. The border remained open. And Turkey now, after I think trying to somewhat play the good cop in this relationship, is trying to reestablish its relations with the KRG through Netjervan Barzani. And so I think you can point to a lot of other situations in the Middle East where you have sort of seen a similar kind of compromise between the rhetoric and the pragmatic tradition. Not always for the best. I mean, we can talk about more of these later, I'm sure. But I mean, on Cyprus, I think that in the most recent negotiations, other people here would know better than I do, but Turkey took a very constructive role. I think it was ultimately the Greek position that undermined the negotiations. If Turkey had better relations with the EU, if Turkey hadn't been, you know, calling the Germans Nazis, if it hadn't doing all sorts of other things to antagonize Europe, it might be able to capitalize off the diplomatic, off its constructive diplomatic role in Cyprus. It might be able to try to push for benefits for the Turkish Cypriots, for the Turkish Cypriot position. You know, now because of the climate that everyone else here has talked about, I mean, it's not going to be able to get the benefits from that.
Jonathan, you want to add
something?
Can I jump
on that? Sure. Just for one quick addendum, and that is that I agree with you, Nick, that we probably are deep into this phase of angry pragmatism. The rhetoric matters.
Oh, yeah.
And it especially matters in terms of the Turkish public. You have a generation of Turks now who are growing up on a diet of very harsh anti-US, anti-European rhetoric that comes from high levels in mainstream media on a daily basis. And that is really corrosive over the long term. We have lots of things that we could complain about in terms of the way we see Turkey, and we kind of calibrate that. I'm waiting to hear more, you know, the kinds of things that when I have to come out and talk about Turkey, the first thing I do is I look at it as a strategic ally and a partner in solving problems. Listen for that about the United States coming from the Turkish media. You can't hear it through the anger, but when we have government to government meetings, you hear it in the pragmatism of the business of getting the work done. And I think you capture it well.
And certainly my impression, and I'm sure you realize this much more, I mean, the people in Turkey don't necessarily realize the impact that things like, you know, the scuffle that happened outside of the ambassador's residence have on U.S. public opinion. Or the fact that U.S. public opinion matters in constraining what the U.S. government can do. Exactly. So I think, yeah, the anger is much of the pragmatism as important in this.
I'm sure Davutoğlu would be very pleased to hear himself described as a pragmatist. So with that, we're going to open the floor to questions, but I would really request very, very emphatically that you don't make statements. Please, just ask your question, and if you make a statement, I'm afraid I'll have to interrupt. So, the gentleman at the front here, and kindly introduce yourself. Gönül, should I be taking several questions at a time? Yes? Okay. And then I saw another hand there, Alan Makovsky. And anyone else?
We are in the line.
Oh, you are? Oh, my God. Okay. So.
I'm Peter Humphrey. I'm an intelligence analyst and a former diplomat. I'm wondering how much autocracy is necessary to put the Article 5 commitments in trouble, to suspend them, or even the NATO treaty as a whole, and if perhaps a quiet demarche to Erdogan along those lines might be useful to lay down a red line on the highway to say you can only go so far before you really are threatened.
So, yes?
Thank you. My name is Deniz Yüksel. I'm a student at Georgetown University, and I wanted to ask about this recent talk in Turkey of a possible expansion of Turkey's presence in northern Syria, specifically into Afrin. There was a National Security Council suggestion that this might be something that Turkey is considering. And my question is basically to anyone on the panel who's interested in answering, to what extent is this just rhetoric, and to what extent is this an actual possibility?
Thank you.
Thank you.
So my name is Fariba Paju. I'm an Iranian journalist and just graduated from Medilla School, Northwestern University. So I want to ask you, it seems that Iran, Syria, and Turkey right now, they can be allies in the region right now. So I want to ask that, what do you think? This union will be, it's a temporary one or a permanent? And also I want to know if it's a permanent one, so what will happen for Israel and Turkey relationship in short time?
Okay, thank you.
Also, I have another question. Is there any possibility the U.S., as we heard in the news, arrest Mr. Gulen and returned him to the Turkey? Thank you.
Thank you.
Mustafa Malik.
You want me to? Okay. I was just. I'm sorry to interrupt you, sir, but I was requested to have this first round dealt with before we move on. I apologize. Sure. So, the question about NATO, what does it take to get Turkey kicked out of NATO? I guess I'll let Jonathan and Dimitar, you're both.
Portugal was a member of NATO for a long time before 1974.
Greece too.
And Greece too, yeah.
Do you care to comment?
No, I don't.
May I then kick in?
Sure.
Not NATO, but we had this debate, of course, also with the EU. Is there a red line when you're going to say, okay, now this means we have to start talking about different relationship? And although, you know, we set like a minimum standard, the introduction of the death penalty. On the other hand, when you set a red line, it means anything else is acceptable. And this is where I have problems with red lines.
I mean, we have a treaty-based agreement that NATO will come to the defense of any ally who is attacked, and that stands. That is an ironclad commitment. That treaty is the underpinning of Western security in the post-World War II era, and that remains.
So we had more of a speculative question about Afrin. Turkey has certainly been making some rude noises about Afrin, threatening to intervene, to attack. And there's quite a bit of shelling that goes on and off periodically. Would anyone on the panel care to respond to how serious those threats seem to be? And perhaps you, Jonathan, as a partner of the SDF and the YPG being part of that SDF, would the United States try to stop that from happening? Is Afrin part of your ecosystem inside Syria?
We're not operating in Afrin, so I can't speculate on what we would do. But we hear what Turkey says. We know that one of the reasons that Turkey launched Euphrates Shield was to prevent a contiguous Kurdish zone in northern Iraq. Presumably, that's one of the motivations for their presence in Idlib as well. And I think we need to turn to our Turkish government surrogate here to explain the Turkish position.
Turkish opposition.
Nick, would you like to say something?
Yeah, I guess I'll quickly say two things. First of all, I think Turkey would have good reason to be wary about carrying out an operation in Afrin. On the other hand, there have been a lot of threats, and I think it would be foolish to think that that was all purely bluffing, that there weren't some situations in which Turkey would make good on these threats. This brings me to my second point, which, you know, myself, a lot of other people in the think tank community in D.C. have written that the best thing the United States could do for Turkey and for stability in the Middle East in the long run is try to bring both the PKK and the Turkish government back to the negotiating table. I also happen to agree, as we've just heard, that that's not going to be possible anytime soon, certainly before 2019 and maybe afterwards. In light of that dilemma, I think the one thing that the United States could do most constructively right now is to at least keep the situation from escalating. And it would seem that anything the United States can do, any way it can use its leverage to both keep Turkey from launching operations against the YPG in Rojava, and at the same time to keep Kurdish terrorists from carrying out more bombings in, you know, Western Turkish cities, as we saw in the past couple years. You know, these either step by either side could be enormously destructive, put hopes for peace much further off in the long run, and anything the United States can do to prevent either of those steps would be I think, enormously constructive.
Well, the Russian perspective is, I mean, there was plenty of speculation that the whole business about setting up a de-escalation zone in Idlib was conditioned by the Turks on cooperation or endorsement or green line, whatever you call it, by Russia to invade Afrin. But I don't think it's working like that, whatever the content of the deliberations behind the scenes. The Russian monitors are still embedded in Afrin, and it seems to me that Moscow hasn't conceded that Turkey has a free hand in the enclave.
So moving on to the other question about how sustainable is Turkey's cooperation with Iran, and I think you said the regime inside Syria. Inside Syria. And how does that affect Turkey's relations with Israel? Would you care to respond? Maybe you, Kati, as a European, because Europe has relations with Iran, with Russia.
Maureen, if you allow me, I'm really happy to give my opinion when I have one. But I really deal more, you know, with EU-Turkey relations and what's going on inside Turkey and how it affects the accession process. So this is, you know, where I feel less comfortable.
I was just trying to discriminate positively.
I know, my dear. Thank you.
So maybe you would like to say something about that.
All I can say on it is we've shared with the Turks our profound misgivings about the reliability of Iran as a partner in the Astana process.
Okay, that was quick. And the final question was about Fethullah Gulen, but I think that was pretty speculative. Would the United States arrest him and extradite him? I don't. I think we'll just pass on that one if we may, because it's very speculative and there's a due process of law in the United States. And the gentleman, your question.
Yeah, if I may, Mustafa Malik is my name. Pursue that question of Fethullah Gulen. Gulen came into this country when he tried to destabilize, according to the previous government, two former CIA officers and a former American ambassador to Turkey were instrumental in giving him the green card. It's all documented.
Yes, could we have the question, please?
Question
sir?
Is, yes. Now he is accused by the Turkish government of orchestrating the coup. How could you think? That is the main issue. And 8 out of 10 Turks believe in this.
Yes, so what's the question,
My
sir?
Question is that how realistic is it and how fair it is that you turn a deaf ear to their demand for extradition? American bombs started falling in Afghanistan.
Okay, sir, we get the question.
Yes,
thank
Afghanistan
you.
Because America accused the conspirators.
Yes, thank you very much. Alan.
Thank you. Alan Makovsky, Center for American Progress. Jonathan, I wanted to ask you about the S-400s. It certainly seems, more than I would say many observers thought, based on Turkish statements over the last few months, that Turkey is serious about taking the S-400s, down payments and all the rest. How important an issue is it? How much of a danger would it be to NATO? There was a quote, I believe anonymous, from a DOD official recently linking it to the F-35s, saying Turkey takes S-400s, they might not be able to get the F-35s, the Joint Strike Fighter, which Turkey has contributed to. I wonder, is that real? And I also just wanted to ask you lastly, if it's okay, one of the talking points which Turks have used regarding this issue is to say, well, Greece has the S-300s. Now, of course, some of us old-timers in the room remember that Greece took those S-300s under very different circumstances. I believe, actually, we asked them to because we didn't want Cyprus to take them. Turkey was threatening action against Cyprus if they went through with deploying S-300s. So they're now on Crete. I just wanted to know how are they used by Greece? How good of a talking point is that, in effect, on the Turks' part? And, Madam Moderator, if I could just make one statement. I'm sorry, just very quickly. I don't know how much Jonathan talks to journalists, but I do want to say, as a former State Department official, It's very rare for State Department officials to be on a panel with think tankers. Most of them insist on speaking alone so they don't have to mix it up. This is at least the second time I know of Jonathan doing that, and I want to salute him on that. So thank you.
Kudos to Gunul Tol for that. She got him both times at least.
Hi, I'm Jonas Paul-Klesner, senior fellow with the Hudson Institute. My question was going to be to mainly to Jonathan Cohen on when you mentioned the relation with SDF-YPG were transactional and temporary and limited, and the next phase, if you could talk a little bit more about the next phase also in connections with the sort of still uncertain political settlement in Syria. And then I link in my former colleague Dimitar Bechev and ask about Russia in the same context of, because if the U.S. relations with SDF-YPG are limited, I mean, the Russians have also reached out to YPG, the Syrian Kurds, and so I wondered also your thoughts on that, how that could end triangularly with Turkey, how that will evolve in these continuing discussion over how Syria settled.
Okay, so for this second round, we kick off with a question from the gentleman about Fethullah Gulen. He seems to be advocating that Fethullah Gulen ought to be extradited. I don't know if anyone on the panel feels like commenting on that.
Well, let me take this.
Sure.
The attempted coup in which about 250 people died and thousands were wounded was an attack on democracy and a tragedy for Turks. And we are committed to helping Turkey bring to justice those who are responsible for that failed coup. Turkey's request for the extradition of Fethullah Gulen is an issue that falls partly within the purview of the Department of State, but also the Department of Justice. And we take the requests seriously. The Department of Justice continues to assist the government of Turkey with looking into their concerns. And the Department of Justice has allocated unprecedented resources to the review of Turkey's Gulen-related requests and is continuing to review material that's been provided by Turkey. I'm told by my colleagues at the Department of Justice that they have allocated more resources to this extradition request than any other extradition request they've dealt with since the Shah of Iran.
Wow. Interesting factoid. Okay, so then on the matter of the S-400s, Alan's question, I guess, it's to you again, Jonathan, principally, but maybe Dimitar will like to add a few things.
Let me start with the S-300s in Greece. My understanding is that they are not part of the Integrated National Missile Defense System. I don't believe they are even actively used, but be that as it may, subsequent to the S-300s getting to Greece, and Alan described that was not Greece's decision to acquire a Russian missile defense system, there have been agreements in NATO that NATO allies would, to the extent possible, use NATO interoperable weapon systems. And we encourage Turkey to reconsider purchasing a non-NATO system, especially one as important as national missile defense. In addition to interoperability concerns, we've had discussions with them about other potential implications of that purchase, because it could have a chilling effect on the ability of other NATO defense industries, not just from the U.S., but from all NATO countries, in the fields of technology transfer and co-production. There's also an issue of congressional interest, and Congress has laid down a marker that they are concerned about this, and they believe that it may have implications through the CATSA Sanctions Act. That's the Countering America's Adversaries Through Sanctions Act, and has asked the State Department for an assessment of how the purchase would affect Turkey's ability to receive security assistance from the U.S. So we take this discussion very seriously, and we hope that Turkey will choose not to continue this transaction.
Yeah, just to echo the argument that back in 98 when the compromise on S-300s was struck, that was not a concession to Greece, it was a concession to Turkey. So Turkey is using something that it was given us. So that has to be kept in mind. And if it was a one-off, it's hard to derive any policy conclusion. I mean, there's some speculation about S-400s, but the geographic location of possible deployment, that's probably Turkey will have a freer hand how it deploys it, but I'm certainly not a military expert to comment on that. I'm not a military expert to comment on the technicalities.
Gotcha.
But again, I it's important to know that it's not a done deal, whatever Erdogan or anybody else says.
Yeah. Do you have anything to add? Nick?
I'll just mention the extradition issue, since certainly some things people seem to care about. You know, as time's gone on, the evidence that members of the Gulen movement were involved in the coup seems to be mounting. But the challenge from the outset, and I think people wrote it at the time, was always going to be to make the case for extradition that would link the events of the coup to Gulen himself, who's the individual that they're trying to extradite. It's not necessarily a terribly high bar for extradition, but it's a very inflexible one. The United States court system has to be convinced. If it turns out that the Turkish government has given, you know, strong and compelling evidence that would require Gulen's extradition and the United States government hasn't acted on it, I, as an American citizen, will be outraged. From what I've seen of the Turkish indictments, from what I've seen of the Turkish rhetoric surrounding this, that seems highly unlikely to me. If you actually look at the indictments that have been presented in Turkish courts, you know, again, they tend to delve into conspiracy theories. They begin with the U.S. or sort of the mastermind orchestrating the Gezi Park protests. And the actual specific link to Gulen in, you know, again, the Turkish indictments I've seen comes exclusively through the testimony of two anonymous informants who subsequently had some of their testimony discredited. So again, based on that, you know, if the evidence was there, I think it would be great if the extradition could proceed. Given the absence of evidence, you know, it would be nice if people in Turkey would recognize there's only so much the United States can do.
Kati has something to add.
Yeah, because of course also when it comes to EU-Turkey relations, we have, you know, the possible extradition of Gulenists who were or were not directly involved in the coup is an issue. And, you know, this is where Turkey is really cutting itself in the finger. Because even if there would be members of the Gulen movement who were directly involved on the night of the coup, and it could be proven, I don't see how we could extradite them under the current circumstances in Turkey, where we have reports about torture, where we have reports about what's happening in prison. I mean, we also have international obligation not to extradite anyone to a country where there is the fear of serious mistreatment. So here again, you see that I don't think the Turkish government understands how they are dealing now with these massive arrests in Turkey creates an obstacle in terms of extradition on anyone who might have been even directly involved in the coup on the 15th of July.
So a final round of questions, and they must be specifically related to Turkish foreign policy.
Yeah, absolutely. I got one. My name is Elias Grohl. I'm a writer for Foreign Policy Magazine. It's a question for Mr. Cohen. I'm wondering if you can describe the conversations that occurred between the U.S. and the Turkish government in the run-up to the announcement that Zarab would testify on behalf of the prosecution in the case being brought in New York. Was there a deal offered by the Turkish government to free U.S. consular employees, for example, in exchange for Zarab's freedom? Did the United States government ever entertain such a deal?
I can only speak for the conversations I've been party to. We haven't had that conversation, and we would not entertain that kind of a deal. But for anything about the Zarab judicial process, I have to refer you to the Department of Justice. What I can tell you a little bit about the Americans who are incarcerated and the American government employees who are incarcerated in Turkey and the assurances that we got from the Turkish government about them.
Was there ever a swap envisioned? I mean, what does those negotiations look like? And were you ever willing to offer anyone back to the Turkish government in exchange? Was a swap something that the government entertained? Taking the name Zarab out of the conversation, was a swap ever on the table?
Not in any conversation that I've had. What I can tell you is that when we raise the cases of Americans and U.S. government employees who are incarcerated in Turkey, the Turks will often raise the cases of Turks who are incarcerated in the United States. But we've never had, in any conversation that I've been in, a conversation about a swap. I would refer you to Prime Minister Yildirim's comments after his visit to Washington, which were welcome when he said that they were not looking for a political arrangement for a prisoner swap.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Thank you. My question is to Mr. Khan. You
Could
said
you introduce yourself?
My name is Dasko Shirwani, and my question is to Mr. Khan. You said you do what President say, but in Kurdistan, State Department did what opposite what President said. Because President said we have
your question needs to be about Turkish foreign policy as it relates
well, it's
to
a Turkish,
the European Union or
well,
the
he's
United
from
States.
State Department.
No, I'm afraid you have to limit yourself to Turkish foreign policy. You'll have other opportunities to question U.S. policy on Iraq and the Kurds, but not here today. Thank you. If you have another
you.
Question, though, please feel free. Thank you. We get it. Thank you. Could you please introduce yourself?
Yeah. My name is Safan Lahar, the Turkish correspondent for Anadolu Agency. And I would like to let you know that at the beginning, my question is not directly related with Turkish foreign policy, but my question goes to Katir Piri about her position.
Do you feel like responding, Katir?
Of course, I'm
it's a
politician.
Question.
You always have to respond.
And
to
that was the question, actually, I really want to ask. Before, Mrs. Piri, you said the European Union should formally suspend Turkey's long stalled. Talks on European Union membership. And you gave HDP MPs arrest as an example and as one of the reasons. However, when Spain issued an arrest warrant on Catalonian leader and, used by excessive violence.
Could we get to the question,
yeah,
please?
Yeah. Excessive violence by the Spanish police on protesters, you and European Union did not condemn or said anything about it, and people are thinking that there's a double standard. What's your comment on this? Thank you.
I'm happy to answer. Now, right now, the European Parliament, including me, have not called for the formal suspension of the accession talks. Now, we said if this new constitutional package will be implemented in 2019, I think that's the moment we have to formally suspend these talks, because with such a constitution in place, I don't see how any dialogue on full membership of the EU makes any sense anymore. We did say, and that happened indeed after in the week when at that moment 10 members of the Turkish parliament from HDP were arrested in the same week that the Cumhuriyet journalists were arrested. This was all last year, December. This is when the European Parliament called for a freeze of the accession talks. Meaning we shouldn't formally suspend it, but we should right now stop negotiating as if nothing happened. Now, I know I saw many people from Turkey on my Twitter account commenting heavily on Catalonia and what was happening there. I can tell you, although I don't think the situation is comparable, for me, in Europe, not a single politician should be in jail, whether it's in Turkey, whether it's in Spain. So my position on that is clear. I don't think the situations are comparable, but I think, you know, even if Spain has the constitution on its side for what it's doing, it's not a good signal to have directly elected parliamentarians in jail for their political opinion. Does it answer? Okay.
So I guess that's it. So thank you all very much, and Gönül will be closing. And thank you, Gönül, for this opportunity. Thank you, MEI.